The witness of ancient wisdom comes from Genesis chapter 32, 9 through 12, and 22 through 32. And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred, and I will do you good. I am not worthy of the least of all the steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant, for with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I am afraid of him. He may come and kill us all, the mothers with the children. Yet you have said, I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted because of their number. The same night he got up and took his two wives, his two maids, and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and likewise everything he had. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, let me go, for the day is breaking. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. Then the man said, you shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed. Then Jacob asked him, please, tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, for I have seen God face to face, yet my life is preserved. The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the thigh muscle that is on the hip socket, because he struck Jacob on the hip socket at the thigh muscle. The Witness of Modern Wisdom, Jacob and Esau, by Steve Garness Holmes. Jacob and Esau, you will fight. Like Isaac and Ishmael before you and Joseph and his brothers after, you will contend. This is your lot. It is our nature. But it is not your fight. You were born into it. You are Isaac and Rebekah's rivalry, and they will entangle you in it. You are two nations. You are all people. You despise your birthright, deny your belovedness and belonging, think you can steal it, and you despise your brother. Think you can walk away from him, escape your brotherhood, but you can't escape your family. All the hungry, all the unbelonging, they are yours. And why do you struggle? To find yourself, to be yourself off from, to set yourself off from those closest, to be not them, yet bound. It is to be reconciled, to achieve that gift that cannot be purely given, but must be wrought and then received. You're not trying to untangle the knot, but tie it tighter with that brother who, after all your wrestling, will fall on your neck and kiss you, and you will weep. God is still speaking, and we are still whispering. Thanks be to God.
Thank you, Tony. I hope we were listening. It's in control, isn't it? One of the regrets of my life is that I stopped throwing pots after we moved to Sandpoint in 1988. by throwing pots, I quickly add, has to do with pottery. I took 8 weeks of pottery making lessons just before we moved, and I wish I'd been wise enough to keep learning and practicing, but I didn't. As an art form, making pottery is special. As a spiritual metaphor, it's invaluable. So I direct your attention to the visuals on the communion table, a lump of clay, some shards of pottery, and a glued together piece of pottery. A visual reminder, I hope, that reconciliation isn't easy to achieve. Hand-building pottery doesn't need the clay to be centered. My coffee pot cup reminding me that I shouldn't have a donut with it. It's hand-built, and so it can go any direction. Obviously, it went to the bottom. Thank you. Wheel throwing a lump of clay is the only pottery technique that requires the clay's center must be discovered. It requires a delicate relationship between the potter and the clay. Without the potter's courage and skill, this lump of clay will stay just that, a lump of clay. Finding the clay center is the first big task of any potter. A practice potter may take 5 minutes to discover the clay center. Thomas Hawkins, who is a United Methodist clergy and a master potter, talks about the centering process this way in his book from some years ago, The Potter and the Clay, Meditations on Spiritual Growth. The clay must move into the center of the wheel head. As it slowly spins at first, it is tested to see if the sides are too thin or too thick. If so, the clay is not centered. And then he says, I must repeat my spiraling motions until I have the clay on center. All this centering takes about 5 minutes. It always looks easy. It even feels easy once it's been mastered. Beginners, however, often spend week after week trying to learn how to center the clay. I know I did. Centering clay and the reconciliation process have their parallels, the first of which might be that neither clay nor reconciliation can be forced to find their centers. The clay must be coaxed into its center. Reconciliation requires human freedom to reach out in its own way and in its own time. Clay can get out of center fairly easily if not handled gently. Reconciliation is also a fragile process, susceptible to the whims of our spirits and the whims of those with whom we want to reconcile. Whims both expected and unexpected. Centering depends on the potter using both centrifugal and centripetal forces on the clay. Those same forces function in our efforts to reconcile, whether it's with God or with another person. Centrifugal, centripetal. Anybody know those words? Both of them? You may be more familiar with centrifugal, that invisible dynamic force that that pushes matter out toward the edge or simply spreads it around. In pottery, that forces the clay to naturally pull outward and away from the center. Centripetal is the reverse. It's the inward pressure that the potter uses to keep the clay centered. Actually, resisting the outward pull of the clay's natural centrifugal force. These two forces are in play in spirituality also. One of my favorite spiritual guides is Franciscan Father Richard Rohr. He likes to remind his students and his readers that spiritual pain and conflict are often transmitted to other people. I call that centrifugal pain because it's pushed out to everyone, anyone in its way. You know people like that? You may experience it momentarily like that. But Rohr also affirms that spiritual pain can be transformed, not simply transmitted. In pottery terms, transformed clay is drawn inwardly to its center. Spiritually speaking, centripetal pain is drawn inwardly also, but toward the source of healing, toward the source of reconciliation. We often call that centered source God. Now, this little metaphorical introduction of pottery and spirituality leads us to today's complex slice of the Jacob narrative. Tony read only a small part of the larger story of Jacob for us. To me, Jacob is one of the most fascinating and frustrating characters in the entire Bible. His story is covered in 11 chapters in Genesis, beginning with the 25th chapter, the 19th verse, and going into the 36th chapter, the 43rd verse. Plus, it actually continues in a lesser form through Jacob's death at the end of the 49th chapter. It's a long story. Old Testament Walter Brueggemann called many of these chapters of Jacob's story the conflicted call of God. Why would he do that? Well, I invite you to read the entire story. When you've read that whole story for yourself, carefully, reflectively, then maybe you can find an answer for Brueggemann's calling this a conflicted call of God. God was always there to provide the foundation for reconciliation efforts throughout Jacob's life. But I'm not totally convinced Jacob ever really trusted God or himself enough to get the reconciliation right. His pain was transferred or transmitted centrifugally toward most anybody he knew. It wasn't a centripetal transformation initiated by a trusting friendship with God. In terms of our pottery metaphor, as I try to depict it, Jacob was never really fully centered. From their birth as twin brothers, Jacob and Esau were frenemies, and then enemies, and lastly, frenemies again. Jacob tricked Esau out of his birthright as the firstborn son, then tricked their father Isaac into giving Jacob the blessing Isaac thought he was giving Esau. If that confuses you, go back and read the story. That affected the brothers' relationship their whole lives and resulted in a 20-year separation. Our story today begins with Jacob preparing for a reconciling effort with Esau. Jacob prays to God, but even there, I think he hedges his bets. He admits his fear, yet hangs on to his need to control and manipulate the relationship, both with God and with Esau. Spoiler alert, at least from my perspective, it appears to me that neither brother has any sense that reconciliation can be more than a calculated transaction with winners and losers. Our biblical reading story this morning is only part of the reconciliation effort for Jacob. There are actually two meetings that he must endure. The first you heard told by Tony. It's the all-night wrestling match that he has with some stranger. It's a thoughtful story to reflect on, and I think it's a hopeful one. Jacob and the stranger wrestle to a draw, but Jacob is injured by the stranger and walks away with a limp. We like to see that as a symbolic gesture of humility. We can hope that Jacob has finally learned his life lesson. Well, here is how my United Methodist pastoral colleague, Steve Garness Holmes, poetically describes the night of wrestling. Please listen for his imaginative wisdom in this poem. Traveling between wounds, we pause. Make some space in time. Allow the evening pall to be laid over us, darkness tucked up under our chin, a stillness purely granted, lowering us into a well deeper than thought. Out of the shadows comes another, strange, yet our own. We've kept in shadows, so thought we had no shadow. But now it seizes us, grapples, as if not to destroy, but to hold us to something. We grapple not to defend, but to hold it so we can see it. What is it that knows us better than we do? That knows our weak spots, that has such a grip on us. Our heaven and our earth thrash like desperate lovers mirrored cheek to cheek, not to conquer, but to alter. There is no victory, only embrace. As morning light unfolds, the mystery recedes again to shadow. But not without a blessing, a name. What we wrestle with makes us. We limp gracefully into our broken open future. Well, the second meeting of Jacob that he faces is found in the 33rd chapter of Genesis, verses 1 through 17. It wasn't read this morning, so I ask you to reflect on it for yourselves when you have a chance. I should say when you take the chance. This is when Jacob and Esau actually meet. Here again, part of today's modern wisdom reading, as Steve Garness Holmes describes Jacob and Esau's meeting. It's about almost two-thirds of the way through the poem that Tony read. And he's speaking to Jacob. You despise your birthright, deny your belovedness and belonging, think you can steal it. And you despise your brother, think you can walk away from him, escape your brotherhood, but you can't escape your family. All the hungry, all the unbelonging, they are yours. And why do you struggle? To find yourself, to set yourself off from those closest, to be not them, yet bound. It is to be reconciled, to achieve that gift that cannot be purely given, but must be created and then received. You're not trying to untangle the knot, but tie it tighter with that brother who, after all your wrestling, will fall on your neck and kiss you, and you will weep. Jacob brought his large family to impress Esau and offered great gifts to Esau in some gesture of recompense and reconciliation. Jacob's tears appear deeply felt, but I'm still skeptical of his fuller motive. My incomplete perception? Both Jacob and Esau needed to take the shards of their broken lives in search of some kind of glue that would cement their reconciliation effort. So what's in a reconciliation glue? What holds a reconciliation together? Well, I've thought of a few ingredients. Centered humility, centered trust, centered patience. What other ingredients do you think you might need to, as you consider a relationship that could use a good dose of reconciliation? Remember, God has already implanted those ingredients within you and waits for you to discover them. They are essential before your act of reconciliation can begin and continue in a transformational way. Transformational reconciliation centers on both and, winner-winner thinking and behavior. This effort emphasizes thinking and behaviors meant to restore a relationship with few, if any, conditions. Not using reconciliation glue in your effort really suggests that your heart and actions may be more transactional. That centers on either or, winner, loser, thinking and behavior. It emphasizes more manipulative intent. How can I get what I want out of this reconciliation transaction and still be in control? But for God, in that story and in our stories, there is no such thing as cheap reconciliation. Glue is required. The wrestling match and the brotherly meeting ultimately need each other. Glue can hold together their unique, complex connection. Walter Brueggemann, again, wisely observed that in the holy God there is something of the estranged brother, and in the forgiving brother, there is something of the blessed and the blessing of God. As he wrestled the stranger, Jacob somehow saw the face of God. In his meeting with Esau, He seemed to see that same face. Brueggemann again. The forgiving face of Esau and the blessing face of God somehow seem connected. Reconciliations are seldom as straightforward as we'd like them to be. Jacob's encounter with God left him an empowered and renamed Israel cripple. His reconciliation with his brother included deception. The two meetings belong together in promise and yet still in caution. So as we consider our own needs for reconciliation, whether with God or others or all of the above, let's consider this. Our efforts are always are also never straight lines from hope to realization. Along the way, reconciliation glue is likely needed. And thankfully, it can work, even if applied sparsely. Transactional reconciliation, transformational reconciliation, both are still our choices to make. Either way, God will be there. Maybe even as a stranger in the night. Amen.